from San Francisco. Welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn.
And I had seen the initial designs and participated in the designs of a fully reusable shuttle. And as they defined it then, it needed two stages, fully reusable, a booster stage and an orbiter stage. Now the booster wasn't going anywhere except halfway up and turning around and coming back down, so there was no utilitarian reason in having a crew on the booster except to save the booster in case something went wrong. I felt I was a voice in the wilderness questioning, why do we want to put a crew in the booster? Well, the reason we put a crew in the booster designs were greed, jealousy, and bureaucracy.
It's been nearly a quarter of a century since Buzz Aldrin and the crew of Apollo 11 went to the moon. He spent a mere 2 hours and 15 minutes walking on the moon, and after that, he could have retired. But in the almost 25 years since, Buzz has remained personally committed to America's space program. And today, he believes more than ever that the United States should go forward and build a dynamic space station, one that leads us into the 21st century, back to the moon, and on to Mars. Moira was able to speak with Buzz about his life and his vision for the space program.
I think that most Americans have kind of lost touch with the space station. Hey, you know, is it on? Is it off? I don't think that most people realize that NASA held its first symposium on space station design back in 1958. Could you spend some time and take us through the evolution of space stations to where we are today?
Just the bare thoughts of space have gone through a tremendous amount of changes from the days of Jules Verne's in science fiction and the more dependable people, the pioneers, I guess, starting with Tsiolkovsky and the German Hermann Oberth and the American Robert Goddard, who felt that one could indeed build the machines that could travel through space without having to push against the air, as the New York Times kept insisting that we couldn't go to the moon because a rocket had something to had to push against something. The people who understood physics prevailed as we became more and more wise in these thoughts of the world around us and what we could do with it. And there were the practical people writing papers and doing engineering studies who felt they knew what was happening, and then there was the rest of the world that didn't really pay that much attention. And lo and behold, on the scene came Sputnik. Of course, before Sputnik, we'd had people telling us a little bit about what might happen. Werner von Braun and his various articles. After the end of World War II, as he came to this country and started talking about some of the things that we could do, began to catch the imagination of people. So on to the background of Jules Verne and Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon, on the scene came the reality of, yes, indeed, something could go up into space. And some people were practical in their predictions of what might happen, and that fascinated people. As soon as you start talking about sending things into space, things generally don't catch the imagination of the people quite as much as people do. We almost need to have people somewhere. Arthur Clarke, in 1947, I think it was, when he first wrote a science fiction story talking about the practicalities of space, referred to the magical thing to people in those days that you could have a satellite motionless in the sky. Well, it's not really motionless, but there's still an awful lot of people that think that when we put up a satellite and it stays over the equator, that it's motionless. It isn't at all. It's in orbit. It's in orbit going around the Earth at the same rotational rate that the equator is rotating. That's one revolution in 24 hours, and that's a pretty good clip at the equator, and it's even faster when you get further away because of the greater distance that you have. And it eventually reaches orbital speed at that point, 22,000 miles away. Well, Arthur Clarke really felt that these sort of relay stations would have to have maintenance people there continually around the clock changing the damn vacuum tubes, because in those days, in 1947, 48, the electronics world was really dictated by vacuum tubes in the radio communication, and the diodes and transistors hadn't come along. That concept of a space station to satisfy the communication needs of the world went through a lot of modification. When things became smaller and much more reliable, we didn't need the people there. And now we're talking about putting fleets of very small satellites that if one isn't in sight, then another one will be, and that one can talk to someone else, and so we may have 20, 30, 50, 100 satellites in medium altitude all sort of communicating with each other, and some sooner or later somebody from the ground will tap into that, and so you can carry on a conversation. That's not at all what Arthur Clarke had in mind. So we're going through tremendous changes in what a space station ought to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that as the space program began to mature with manned spaceflight, first the Russian and then the Americans began putting people up in a Mercury program and a Gemini program, and eventually the Russians went through their Vostok to Vashgod and began putting their Soyuz spacecraft up. We both suffered setbacks in terms of crew losses. We suffered a loss with the three astronauts killed in the Apollo fire, and the Soviets lost an astronaut on return from the first testing of the Soyuz spacecraft. When a program is so visible, so many people are interested in the new, the catchy, the intriguing, the adventurous, and we place a high value on tragedy and human life, and a space program that's government-run with taxpayer money tends to grind to a halt with cries for investigation whenever you have an accident. There are accidents all the time, and they're part of the way of life of taking risk in a high-technology world. But when that high risk is high visibility and the people are concerned, then there's a lot more at stake riding on success or failure. And that is governing an awful lot of what we decide to do in space as we move toward establishing some kind of a permanence. I guess at one point you might think that whatever vehicle I have that takes me into space, I can just stay in that vehicle and go wherever I want. That sort of implies a rather infinite fuel supply. And that's okay for Buck Rogers, but that's not okay for the Russian program and our program. You need to specialize the design of a particular craft to do a particular job, and one that has to be launched from the surface of the Earth has to penetrate the atmosphere and has to do a lot of things to make that journey going up, and at any time, because it has a crew on there, something may go wrong and it has to turn around and come right back down again. So at any time it has to go up, continue the successful mission, or turn around and come back down again. And the design of a human container, or a container of humans to do that, is quite a bit different than once you get into space and you want to stay there for a period of time. The container that you need for humans to do that is much, much different. And if we can build that container, put it up there, then the other container or spacecraft that goes up and comes back down again, they can be different. And so that's maturing our thinking about space stations. Now, if we're going to have objects in space that are going to be containers for humans, we have to figure out why we're putting the humans there. If they're there so that they can reach over and turn a dial or observe something, that's probably not the best use of humans. We are building very good observers, sensors, and relays that can respond to observers at a distance. They're called remote devices. And we can communicate with very sophisticated remote devices from a very comfortable, secure, safe place on the ground. Many things can be done very well without the complications of having humans there. I think we put humans in near space because they can exercise their judgment and learn about humans being there so that we can begin to think about taking humans elsewhere. And I think it's just part of the adventuresome spirit of humankind to want to explore the reaches, the boundaries of the physical world that we have. That's been a part of the human quest ever since recorded history, to want to reach out a little bit further and see what's there. As we get wise, we see that there's not much point in a human visiting the corona of the sun. It's a little warm there, and so is walking around on the planet Mercury, not very satisfying. There's not that much to see, and it's hotter than hell, at least on one side it is. Venus has got a hell of a lot of pressure. It's very steamy. That's not very habitable. So we usually think of places that we'd like to have humans go to where it's reasonably comfortable. In orbit, in a vacuum, if you have a container, it's reasonably comfortable. So on the surface of the moon with not much gravity, but a vacuum and temperatures that are reasonable, is a reasonable place to deposit humans for a period of time. The surface of Mars is a reasonable place. And there's much to be gained by looking at the long geological history of the planet Mars firsthand to see whether maybe there's some fossils in the apparently riverbeds of a planet like Mars that once had a fair amount of water flowing over its surface. And if that water was there for reasonable periods of time, it just might have resulted, as it did here on Earth, with the generation of small cellular life. And then when things turned not so habitable anymore on Mars, that may have all died out, but it may have left its mark there. And I think it would be a tremendous advance in understanding our place in the universe to know more about what may have happened on Mars that changed it from a habitable place to a not so habitable place now. It certainly is a lot more comfortable on the surface of Mars than it is on the surface of the moon.
Okay, so Skylab was from what date to what date?
Skylab, I think, was probably put up in 73 or 4, and it was put up unmanned first on a Saturn V, and it was the empty hydrogen tank of the third stage of the Saturn rocket. That was converted on the ground to be a container for the crew. Many things were added to it. They were taken from existing parts that had been engineered and proven by separate development. There were parts of the Gemini hatch that were part of the airlock. There were major parts of the lunar module that were parts of the Apollo telescope mount. Now, that was all stacked above the empty hydrogen stage, and once it was in orbit, it hinged outward. It went through a self-deploying. There was a certain amount of astronaut activity needed to bring that about, but there were hinges and things deployed, and then panels came out in several directions from that Apollo telescope mount as part of Skylab. As much as we knew about the launch of the Saturn, we put two major panels on the side of the third stage to launch it, and what do you know? One of them ripped off during launch, which cut the power supply almost in half of Skylab. And things were weighing in the balance as to whether it was success or failure, just based on that one failure. And if you look at option C right now, it's a big can, and it's got solar panels on the side of it. I hope they've learned a lot from the last 20 years, so that when they put something up with panels on the side like that, they know how to keep them from ripping off.
If you just tuned in, I'm speaking with Buzz Aldrin, former Apollo astronaut and space station proponent. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology.
Back to the middle 70s.
Okay.
And we have Skylab up in space, and then we send three crews on the smaller Saturn rocket. Three different crews go up there to expand our duration, the knowledge of human duration in space. And since we had already put a 14-day mission in space in the Apollo program and the Gemini program, we decided to expand that to 28 days. So the first Skylab mission was for 28 days, and the second was for 56 days. Doubling that, and then for some reason we didn't double the next one, but went to 84 days. I don't know if that had anything to do with around the world in 80 days or something like that. but the third Skylab manned crewed flight established a record that's stayed for quite a while of 84 days in space. But Skylab was not intended to have people relieve on station. In other words, it was up there in orbit, and then we sent a crew up to it, and their major task were to fix the things that were wrong with it when they arrived, and to deploy some things that weren't deployed. And they had to do some spacewalking to be able to control the heat. They set up a shield, sun shade sort of, over parts of the space station to protect it from the heating, adverse heating, because of some of the power losses that they had. The termination of the Skylab program in 74-75 left us with a void of manned spaceflight potential. In the very early 70s, we were looking at what will be the next major program to follow Apollo, and it was clear to most future planners that we needed to have a much more economical access to space for heavy cargo and for valuable cargo, people. Mm-hmm. And you need a place to go. We need a space station. So a part of an integrated plan was developed where we would have a place to go, a space station, and an increasingly economical way to go, and the wonderful world, the wonderful word shuttle came to be. I wish we had chosen better words to describe that particular spacecraft that is so key to our program right now, rather than a word shuttle. We've grown used to it, but it's not a very inspiring word. Well, I think back to the days just as I was leaving NASA with a little bit of sadness, and I had seen the initial designs and had participated in the designs of a fully reusable shuttle. And as they defined it then, it needed two stages, fully reusable, a booster stage and an orbiter stage. And they'd ride together, and then when the booster was empty, it would separate, and the orbiter would light its engines and then go on into orbit. And obviously, the orbiter, for the operational uses, would have a crew in it, and they would do things. It didn't necessarily imply that you had to have a crew on the early flights. Now, the booster wasn't going anywhere except halfway up and turning around and coming back down, so there was no utilitarian reason in having a crew on the orbiter on the booster, except to save the booster in case something went wrong, which means they were along to save their own ass. Okay. Now, all sorts of complications come along when you have people who are there and their only justification is to protect their own safety. Things can get pretty expensive, and they did. It's an example that I look back on because, with some regret, because I felt I was a voice in the wilderness questioning, why do we want to put a crew in the booster? Well, the reason we put a crew in the booster designs were greed. Greed and jealousy and bureaucracy. The Marshall Space Flight Center had the task of defining the booster. Mm-hmm. And they had long been jealous of the Johnson Spacecraft Center, the manned spacecraft center, because they had astronauts.
Yeah.
So they wanted an astronaut in their spacecraft, their booster. Mm. They had major contractors supporting the studies of the booster proposals. And if you ask a major contractor, should I put a cockpit in this or should I not put a cockpit in it? You're asking him, should I make a big profit or a modest profit? So his answer is going to be very biased, and it was. And a reason that we didn't proceed with a fully reusable booster and orbiter was because of greed. It would have served us very well if we had never put a cockpit in that booster, and probably, as was demonstrated by the Russians, not put a crew in the orbiter for the first flight and maybe several flights, because Challenger taught us that we cannot afford to lose humans in the tragic accident of launch. However, we're not investigating the use of uncrewed, uninhabited shuttle craft as a possible solution to our future needs.
You can say unmanned.
I can say unmanned,
yeah,
okay.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, but we've got a lot of people listening.
That's okay. I'll tell them it's
kind
okay.
of picky.
Yeah, I know.
We're still living with a lot of these preconceived influences that want to hold on to the person in charge of a spacecraft as the commander on board. You know, that's been the dictum of piloting craft since the Wright brothers. You ask a pilot who's in charge, and he says, I'm in charge. And you ask somebody these days who has more information, and it isn't the pilot. He sure doesn't have the most information to base a sound decision. When something goes wrong, he's calming his own nerves, trying to figure out what to do next with limited information available in the spacecraft. Most of the information is available through telemetry back to someone on the ground. Now, if that communication link is broken, then the pilot is on his own, and he's in charge, and he has no advice to look to. But we have preconceived feelings about the command authority is always on board. Well, there are a lot of pilots who would look down their nose and say, shame, shame, Buzz, you're just not living up to your profession, by suggesting that maybe the ultimate command resides in the ground or somewhere where there's more information. Now, that information has to be brought to bear in a timely fashion. So there.
But we're talking about here getting a space station up there,
mm-hmm.
and we're talking about manned orbiters, or excuse me, manned spacecraft getting up there and coming back down. Okay.
That's right. But I'm also pointing out the fact that shuttles don't have to be manned.
Mm.
There's a lot of information available to people on the ground to make the decisions and to throw the switches that will cause it to do just what we want it to do without having a crew on board. And the same thing is true to some degree about a station. I mean, I mentioned earlier that if we want a station to do things by making observations and turning dials to make changes in what's happening, we can probably create the robots and the automatic equipment and sensors to do that very well. The human may be an interim available person to facilitate doing those things, so we don't have to, you know, bring them back down again, change them, and send them back up again. But really, I think the human is there to learn more about life sciences, the living conditions of humans in space, because we may want to put them in space for longer periods of time so that we can then send them to the moon for periods of time and then from the moon on to somewhere else. What I'm really saying is that exploration, human exploration outward, is the driving force for putting humans in low Earth orbit in a space station, so that the life sciences, the study of human life in orbit, can really only be justified if we're going to send humans out further away.
Mm.
So when we're trying to justify why we're having a crewed, a human-occupied space station, we are sort of answering the question that we do indeed want to have an exploration program. Well, there are some people that don't think we ought to spend money on an exploration program. We haven't been getting the funding for it. So it really muddies the water to try and say, what's the purpose of the space station? If we don't know that we're going to send humans back to the moon and on to Mars, and don't have a clear understanding that that is amongst our long-term objectives, then we're really treading on very sketchy, unsubstantiated ground to say why we're putting humans up in the space station in orbit, and how soon should we put them there, and what kind of return vehicle should we have.
So the space station is not an end to itself. The space station is a part of a whole program, a whole quest.
That's right. Anything that we do should be viewed as a reasonable progression of capability extension of men and machines in their outward quest for expanding their use of technology.
Moira is speaking with Buzz Aldrin, who along with Neil Armstrong were the first humans to walk on the moon. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with Dr. Moira Gunn. In our second half, Moira continues her conversation with Buzz Aldrin about his life on Earth and in space.
Now, this space station that we've been hearing about for how many years now, the one we keep talking about, the space station, is it going to get funded? Is it going to get up? What is it, 8 years we've been talking about, this space station?
Well, when we proposed a part of an integrated plan following Apollo in the early 70s, mm-hmm. of a space station and an economical
shuttle
transportation system, mm-hmm. a shuttle, Congress was not, and the President were not in that gracious a mood right then. So continually the agency, the government agency of NASA, was wishfully thinking that they could afford this, and then they were told, no, you can't afford that. You're going to have to make some choices, some hard choices. You can't have a space station and a shuttle. Which do you want? Well, building a space station in the early 70s without an economical means of getting back and forth would have been a recipe for disaster. So obviously the solution was, let's design hopefully an efficient transportation system, and we'll defer the station. Well, after we did the Skylab effort of an interim space station supported by the uneconomical Apollo transportation system, just as an interim to buy this over while we're designing the more efficient shuttle system, we decided to do a cooperative venture with the Russians, Apollo-Soyuz mm-hmm. test project, and that eased some of the tensions of the Cold War. It certainly didn't solve the Cold War. It gave us an insight as to what the Russian capabilities were and an initial exchange. And we're building tremendously on those first few steps that were done in Apollo-Soyuz joint flight that took place in 1975. But from 1975 until 1981, not one American flew in space. And of course, the Russians were continuing to improve their Salyut 1, 2, 3, 4. So finally, we got the shuttle off, not in 77, 78 when we thought it would, but it was in April of 81 that the first shuttle flight went up, manned flight. And since that time, of course, we've been increasing the number of flights, and we've been learning more about the economics or non-economics, uneconomics of this new reusable system, which, because of cutbacks, had to be compromised and redesigned several times. And the motivation was, make it cheaper now. Don't pay too much attention to what it costs 5-10 years from now, but we want it cheaper now. So it was upfront costs. The kind of things that you'd like to invest in the upfront costs now, so that it can be fully reusable and simpler and easier to operate and cheaper in the long run. Those long-range objectives were sacrificed in the design of the shuttle system that we have today. And we're now paying the price for it, and we're going to continue to pay the price for it. So these have some implications as to what our choices maybe should be in, as we look at various options for the space station.
Space programs don't operate on multiples of 4 years, and yet each presidential administration leaves its mark. Some people like the space program, some people don't, some people want to go to the moon, some people want stations, and the Clinton administration is no exception. Daniel Golden, the NASA administrator, has had to do a 90-day scramble to come up with three options for the space station that cost half as much as the last proposal. How can you design something as complex as a space station in 90 days, and how can you rely on the cost estimates that would be generated, and what happens when you design to cost as opposed to functional capability?
I don't know. Those are very, very imposing questions. We do the best with what we're asked to do. I'm a military person, and just...
You do it.
You tell me what you want done, and I'll do it the best I can. Sometimes I'll question why you're asking me to do these things. And in the world of politics, I think we're learning more and more. We somehow, every so often, need to pause and ask, what is the inner agenda? What does somebody have in mind? What are they trying to do? You know, we have a lot of different forces at work with their own agendas and their own particular interests for the outcomes when we start playing with how much public money is going to be spent on this or that. Back in the fall of 83, when we still had not had a commitment to the space station, I felt that the best thing this nation could do was to reach out further and to define an objective and then move toward that objective and fill in the intermediate steps. And the best objective that I could think of was a return to the moon program in 83. And that's why, after giving a little bit of thought, I coined a phrase that was published in a magazine that said, the solar system's most desirable space station already has 6 American flags on it. Let's use it and not turn it over to foreign pioneering frontiersmen. Well, in those years, 1980, the mid-80s, we were in the midst of a Cold War, and foreign pioneering frontiersmen referred to the Soviets, but not only that, but it referred to the growing Japanese capability in space and to the growing European influence. So many foreign pioneering frontiersmen might be the recipients of what we chose to turn away from, i.e. the moon, returning to the moon where 6 American flags are. If that was our objective, we would build a program that would give us the capability to go there in a methodical way. And where and when we needed space facilities like stations, laboratories, support facilities, we would build them in an appropriate, methodical way, because we had in mind what our objectives were. Well, we chose not to make that our objective in the presidential speech in 1984. We set our sights on a space station to be built within 10-year period. And we're coming up on a 10-year period, and we're not very close to that space station. What was envisioned then is a far cry from what we think we might be able to do with another 10 years, possibly, on top of that. And the costs, of course, have really grown out of hand. there were a number of different concepts in mind in the mid-80s as we progressed on up through the Challenger accident and the reappraisal of the whole space program that came about because of the Challenger accident 2 years after we had committed ourselves to a space station. So now we have a retrenchment and a protecting of turf because of the accusations that came after the Challenger accident, and now we have a space station, a big program, and of course that just added to the bureaucracy and the trying to prevent things of that nature happening with this space station program. So now we're trying to deal with the presence needed in space as a stepping stone, not that we're going to use that on our way to somewhere, but we're using it in our understanding of human activities that are going to take place elsewhere. So that allows us to draw in maybe the size and the scope.
So you're reducing the functional capability.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so that helps with cost.
Well, it certainly does. It defers the cost. We're still going to end up trying to do things the most economical way by having a human presence in space, in orbit, and then taking humans and going somewhere else. It's just that they're not as intimately intertwined right now. Mm-hmm. We'll probably send humans somewhere else without them stopping on the way at a space station before they go or before they come back again. And I think it's clear to understand that we're not trying to do that with a space station anymore.
Now, there are three options that are being developed. Do we know what they are yet?
Well, we know what they are. The first options that maybe came out of the result of this direction to redesign were a gathering of 15, 20 major submissions to NASA, I guess invited by the NASA headquarters people. They said, well, we'd like to have you people tell us what you think it ought to be. So they kind of early in the game narrowed this down to about three or four different choices, and none of them really made extensive use of the presently designed space station Freedom. The major truss elements were not a part of any of the initial options. This disappointed a number of people. The most importantly, the people that make the long truss, the McDonnell Douglas people, but also the people in Congress who have been struggling to support a space station, and the space station has been designed for so many years. They felt somewhat abandoned now when the White House tells NASA to redesign the space station and NASA comes up with something that doesn't look anything at all like it. They feel like maybe this is a setup for disaster, a setup intentionally to maybe give Congress an unacceptable choice, and Congress would then say, gee, I don't think you guys know what you're doing. This doesn't look anything like what you had before. I don't think you deserve to get funded. So we're just not going to fund this space station effort. You've given us a perfectly good reason for denying funds. And the White House can say, well, gee, we did the best that we possibly could. We campaigned supporting a space station. We asked the most knowledgeable people to come up with a redesign, and they came up with something that's unacceptable. Oh, gee, too bad. We did the very best we could, but really it's Congress's fault because they're the ones that denied the funds. But we'll go spend them somewhere else. Those kind of agendas may be going on, and in some people's minds they certainly are going on. Whether you can really say that that's a strong motivation behind the major actions that have taken, I don't think you really can, but certainly they're in some people's minds that indeed may be happening. Now, there are a number of us that really want to see manned spaceflight continue, and we really, at the bottom of our hearts, believe that we need to move toward a human presence in orbit of some kind that makes sense, and then go on with the business of making more economical the delivery of people and cargo, and building together in a long-range, integrated, totally integrated plan, a way to begin to expand our capabilities without getting caught in a trap of a white elephant, whether it's a shuttle or a massive structure in space that's going to absorb all the funds that we can possibly marshal together. We don't want something like that. We want something that is able to expand in a evolutionary way. And to start out with a clean sheet of paper right now, as much as we may feel that a particular design is something we really want in 5 or 10 years, so let's throw away everything we got and let's work on that design now. I can do that, and I've done that. If you were to ask me a year ago or 2 years ago what's the best space station design, I'd probably say a large volume that is centrally supports the utilities around it in a rather compact way, something that once you put it together in orbit in space, you could also transport it somewhere else without it flapping apart as you're trying to do that. It could have multiple uses projected, and it probably would involve a big can, and it would have solar arrays going out from it in many directions, and it would have thrusters attached to it, and I've spent a lot of time trying to think of how that, what it should look like. And we have a nice little drawing of what that ought to look like as we can see it right now. It's better than the option C, big can, being looked at. That option C that's being looked at by the Johnson Spacecraft Center is severely constrained by cost and weight restrictions to put it into space.
Mm-hmm.
It may be near what we ought to do, but if it can't be what we really ought to do, then it's compromised right from the beginning, and it's starting with a clean sheet of paper. And it may have some great advantages, but I don't think it's what we should be doing at this point. What we should be doing is taking what we've invested in for the past 8-9 years, maximizing our return from that within the economic constraints that have been imposed on us by the people we work for. And in the space program, you work for the president. And the president is the source of direction for our space program. And hopefully we can come up with something that satisfies what we hope he wants to do, and that we can sell that to the Congress. And if we don't sell it to the Congress, then it's not going to make it. It's not going to do us any good at all. So I really think what we have worked on, a little group of people, we may call ourselves StarCraft visionaries or something of that description, but there are some independent people that we borrowed from here and there with different talents for artistic work, for putting words together, for engineering, networking with other people, and some real professional loaned assistance in the early stages of our looking at taking bits and pieces of the truss of freedom and in a very minimum way getting an early capability in space quickly that uses most of what Space Station Freedom has worked on, very minor changes, and then allows us to take that and use that with the Russian capabilities or not as we see fit, but try and take advantage of them. And if we do work with the Russians, I think we should do more than just put our facility in the same orbit.
Need to work with
we
them.
Should work closely. We should attach and detach what it is we're doing with the Russian presence in orbit. We shouldn't attach it, bolt it, and leave it there forever. It should be flexible, capable of being attached and then detached. A space station of the Russians and a space station of ours are spacecraft. They can maneuver, they can come close to each other, they can attach themselves and mutually support themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's with this in mind that we've designed the Science Station Eagle, or Eagle Station, as we call it, as a better solution, a more credible solution, making maximum use of existing work that has been done on the Freedom Space Station and coming up with a minimum austere capability and then expanding that gradually.
So this is option D here at this point.
Well, maybe we ought to call it E for Eagle.
We'll let D slip in there. Letters. We can be Eagle. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. My guest today is Buzz Aldrin, former Apollo astronaut, and we're talking about Science Station Eagle. In the May 17, 1993 edition of the Washington Post, they quote John Logsdon, a space policy analyst from George Washington University, and he says, "We have a system in which, for better or for worse, politicians tinker with engineer blueprints, and engineers must play politics." Now, what happens when you take engineers and you have to play politics?
The engineers are generally going to have an alliance of their own to a corporate structure where their paycheck comes from, where their promotions come from. They're going to generally evidence, put forth a design that comes from a bias of corporate motivations or bureaucratic motivations, or our organization has worked on this for quite a while. We may not have a piece of the hardware, but we feel a pride of ownership. They're not apt to entertain alternate outside ideas that they didn't think of. For some reason in this country, there's not enough incentive to reach out and find out what the other guy is thinking and what he's doing, and then try and incorporate that into your thinking and into your plans. There's not enough outreach and a desire and incentive to work with the other guy's ideas and make his ideas a part of yours. Instead, there's the opposite. Another guy's ideas are a threat to your idea because he's going to get credit for it and not me. I don't get any credit as an insider for obtaining the outsider's ideas and bringing them in. Now, there really should be something like that, but there isn't in politics, in bureaucracy, and in industry, and there really should be. In the engineering world and many others, we call it not invented here, is a big impediment to progress. I talked about engineers having vested interest when they begin to play politics. I think one of the things that I have tried to pride myself in is the independence of outside influence that has to do with a particular hardware design or return of profit on a particular concept or idea. I've tried to remain independent of that, and at the same time, I've tried to augment that by patting myself on the back whenever I change my mind and have an open mind and entertain a new and different idea. I didn't think too much of unmanned orbiters when I first heard of them. I didn't think too much of airplanes launching rockets, but I've investigated those and learned that they have great attractiveness to them as future concepts. I certainly didn't think that this shuttle system that we are living with now should be prolonged much beyond the first opportunity we have to replace it with something else. But lo and behold, I feel in the long run, the best way to get back to the moon and to Mars is, believe it or not, to keep the shuttle flying, but to change it in a way that lets us gradually increment the launch system that takes the shuttle into orbit. Just play a little shift around here and there. Replace the solid rocket boosters with liquid rocket boosters that can fly back and be returned, that have much more power. Then we can begin to work on the tank and put the engines from the orbiter onto the tank. And then when we don't have engines on the orbiter, then we can maybe put a couple of more strap-on liquid rocket flyback boosters. And pretty soon, before we know it, we've gradually improved the shuttle system and we have a very capable rocket that can take us back to the moon and on to Mars.
You know, I'm absolutely amazed at how many options you have for so many. It's like you're constantly thinking, Buzz. I look at this and I think you've received scores of national and international awards. You've got the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the Air Force Legion of Merit, such exotic awards as Thailand's Order of the White Elephant. I like that one a lot.
But I don't have very many for being innovative and creative and developing the rendezvous techniques that helped us successfully carry out the Gemini program and Apollo. You don't see very many awards in my repertoire for doing that, do you?
Ah, well, my question is why, it's not your generative powers, then, your creative powers. It's been more for putting your foot on the moon.
That's right, yeah. I'm not supposed to be creative and helpful to the space program today. That doesn't fit the mold. And maybe it threatens people who are in the mold they think of doing the things that are supposed to be done. And an outsider who kicked up dust on the moon has no business monkeying around with their turf.
Well, it's interesting. I was listening last week. Dr. Bernice Johnson at the Smithsonian said, when you charge the air, you must have courage. You must be honest and you must tell the truth. Sounds like you charge the air, Buzz.
Yeah, and sometimes the sparks burn a little bit when they get turned back on me. There have been times when I have been unsure of what direction we ought to go. Uh-huh. And I was unsure when I looked at those designs of those shuttles, those reusable shuttles. But somehow I had this gut feeling that we didn't want to put a cockpit in that booster. And I had some misgivings about a space station instead of returning to the moon, because I wasn't sure that we understood what the space station was for. And we fell into a trap of thinking that it was a port facility in space.
Yeah.
And I fell into a number of other traps along the way, but it's become clearer and clearer as I look at another very key ingredient of wisdom that has come out of the experience of watching the space station move along, and that is that we're combining apples and oranges. We're combining humans and non-human stuff. We're combining laboratory delicate work with life science work. Those two many times are incompatible. It would be very fortunate if we could design a facility and we'll say for 6 months this is going to be life science only. You guys who are interested in laboratory work, stay away. Your time will come. And then another 6 months, now we're going to say get rid of the centrifuge, get rid of the bicycles and all the rest of this exercise stuff. This is laboratory now. Don't you guys move. Don't shake anything for 6 months. No docking, no nothing. Well, we can't quite design something to do that. And trying to put those two, unmanned, laboratory, sensitive, microgravity work together with life sciences is wrong. We should not do that in one facility. That is what freedom has been designed to do from the word go, to put those together in one facility. Our design, ego, lets us do it differently. We start with a very small design, and we can stop any time we want. We can add some power to it, and we can take advantage of the technical control in orbit of gravity gradient initially. We can add more power, and then we can make very efficient our ability to track the sun and to get microgravity.
Uh-huh.
And we can take a small station consisting of a node and some launches to put power and radiators and thrusters, and we can have a duplicate to that, as we should have with Skylab. We can take that duplicate, and when the time comes, we can put that duplicate in space and have these two join up with each other and separate.
Sounds like a Lego system.
One can be attached to the Russian space station while the other one is unmanned doing microgravity work. Eagle will let us do that. Eagle will also let us get human presence cheaper, sooner than any of the other options. Eagle will let us get microgravity laboratory work visited by Soyuz, visited by shuttle, attached and then detached from Mir, or just by itself. All these different ways the Eagle station can do better than the other options.
Let me ask you one last question. You know, NASA has extensive physiological data on you from both your Gemini mission.
You're making me nervous.
And your Apollo mission. And in the interest of studying the effects of aging, they have made room for you on an upcoming shuttle flight. Will you go?
No.
Come on, Buzz.
It's hazardous.
You won't go?
I didn't say I won't.
You got 3 seconds.
My contributions
future
spaceflight are better right now on the ground than they are in space. And I'd like to make one other observation. NASA's own numbers, substantiated by engineers who are expert in predicting success and failure, indicate that between now and the year 2000, when we may possibly have a space station up and operating, if we fly shuttles at the rate of about 8 per year, the chances of reaching the year 2000 without an in-flight fatality is about 20%.
Sure.
That's not very good.
So you're
that
not
means
go?
We're likely to maybe have to deal with another tragedy, another loss of an orbiter.
What do you figure it was on Apollo 11?
You're dodging the issue. I'm dodging the issue. I'm trying to create an environment where the public listening in understands that this is not a risk-free business.
Well, that's
we have true. Successes, and we've had marvelous successes in the Apollo program. We've had a few things go wrong. We burned up a crew.
That's right.
We blew up an oxygen tank, which then blew up another oxygen tank in the same spacecraft. That's never supposed to happen. Yet it did happen to that lucky space flight number 13.
That's right.
And it forced them to turn around and come back, to the great credit of a teamwork working back here on Earth, where the information really was. It wasn't in Jim Lovell's head, and it wasn't in Fred Hayes' checklist. The information that brought them home safely was in the work, the dedicated work of a team of people back here on Earth. And that's where the command authority should be. Now, we will take risks, and we must expect that sometimes we'll lose. We must have a plan that is resilient, that is capable of having problems, having setbacks, and not causing us to wring our hands and say, oh, let's give up the whole thing. It wasn't worth it from the beginning. We need a very active program, an active program that gives us variety, gives us the ability to choose as we go along, to make adjustments, to change. That's modularity. That's
Are you going to go, Buzz? Are you going to go? There's a seat with your name on it.
I'm going to go on an air launch, safe spacecraft.
Named Eagle.
No, it's going to be named Starbird.
Okay.
And it's a three-stage, fully recoverable wings and wheels.
Moira's guest has been Buzz Aldrin, Apollo 11 astronaut, who along with Neil Armstrong became the first men to walk on the moon. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco Songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Special thanks for additional facilities at KLON-FM in Long Beach. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.